This is an ABC podcast.
Hundreds of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander delegates at the Uluru Convention told the Australian people what they wanted. A voice to advise Parliament on their affairs.
A push for a referendum to establish a new Indigenous advisory body has been dumped by the Federal Cabinet.
It's a pragmatic level of thinking about the reality of what will fly with the Australian people and what won't.
The story of the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians is contested and complex. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders are the first people, and their land, way of life and culture was forever changed with the arrival of Europeans. Hello, this is Rear Vision on RN. I'm Annabelle Quince. Over 3 weeks, we're going to trace the story of Australia's relationship with its Indigenous people, from the time of Federation in 1901 through to the Uluru Statement in 2017. While we can't cover the whole story, we can look at how Indigenous communities and families have been shaped by government policies, and how their survival against all odds has shaped all of us.
When Captain Cook anchored off the beach in Botany Bay on the morning of April the 29th, 1770, he and his crew were confronted by a group of Australians, curious as to what the white man wanted in this remote part of the world. Today, just on 200 years later, Aborigines still live across Botany Bay from Cook's landing place, on traditional tribal grounds at La Perouse.
The arrival of Europeans in 1788, while celebrated by many white Australians, is seen as an invasion by Indigenous Australians, and one that led to a dramatic decline in their population. Pat Anderson is the chairperson of the Lowitja Foundation.
Since the arrival of the First Fleet, and it was an invasion from those on the shore, it was a full-scale invasion. However, for those on the ships, of course, it was settlement. So our understanding and our experience of that coming is bloody, it's murderous, it's unforgivable, the decimation of people through firearms and what have you, because we only had spears, of course, and all the stories about the poisonings and the massacres and the spread of blankets with smallpox and what have you. Whatever the real truth is, definitely it was a full-scale attack on those people who were, for 65,000 years, had lived on this beautiful continent. So that's my understanding of what happened at that time in 1788. And by 1901, it wasn't complete, but certainly there was a decimation of the peoples who were first here.
The current scholarly consensus is probably that the Aboriginal population prior to contact with Europeans was anywhere between 750,000 and 1.5 million.
Bain Attwood, Professor of History at Monash University.
In terms of the number of Aboriginal people in 1901, it's thought to be something in the order of 100,000. So you, of course, can do the arithmetic. So we're talking about this large-scale depopulation. Or by that stage, indeed much, much earlier than that, there's a widely held assumption that Aboriginal people are a dying race, that they are doomed to extinction.
Most older white Australians had seen the population decline all over the country in the 1880s and 1890s. You have stories from many, many towns.
Henry Reynolds, Honorary Research Professor, Aboriginal Studies, Global Culture and Languages at the University of Tasmania.
We have to report today that Old Queen Bess, the last of the local tribe, passed away, or King Billy, been about the town for so long, and he was the last of the local tribe. So there was that awareness, there was that empirical awareness.
Disease played a major part in this population decline, but according to Tim Rowse, Professor Emeritus at the University of Western Sydney, this was not the only factor.
The arguments are really about what were the main contributors to that decrease, and it's very likely that disease, including reduced fertility, was the main reason, but there was also a lot of killing.
The other thing, apart from the empirical evidence, the evidence in front of them, was the overwhelming intellectual importance of social Darwinism. This was the great scientific achievement of the age. Anyone who was up to date, anyone who was modern, accepted the truth of evolution. And it was assumed evolution applied to human races, like to species in the natural world. And primitive human races were dying out, and nature had dictated that, and there wasn't much that could be done about it. So in a sense, they felt that the Aborigines had no long-term future.
On the 1st of January 1901, Her Majesty was graciously pleased to proclaim the colonies constituted into the Federal Commonwealth of Australia.
The expectation of someone like Deakin, who was quite central to the writing of the Constitution, was that in the longest settled or longest colonised parts of Australia, the Aboriginal population was disappearing, either physically disappearing or being absorbed into the white population, and that in a few generations' time there would be no significant Indigenous population at all. In the north, they were aware that in northern Australia there were still untouched, uncolonised tribes, but people were pretty confident that once they were contacted, they would fall into a pattern that was called detribalisation, which would be so rapidly destructive of them physically and culturally that in a few generations after contact, they also would no longer be present as a distinct people. So the confident assumption is that there was not going to be a distinct Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander population within Australia in the foreseeable future.
There were people who believed that the only way to stop the decline in the Indigenous population was to protect Aboriginals and Torres Strait Islanders from the white community.
The notion that Aboriginal people were at the risk of extinction and they could only be saved if they were protected from deleterious contact with a particular kind of European men. And the notion was that the best way to protect Aboriginal people was to remove them physically from those influences. And that's in large part why reserves, where they would be supervised ideally by Christian missionaries, this was the idea that this is how you would save Aboriginal people. And there they would be taught what was called civilization, as well as being taught Christianity. The ideal, at least in the beginning it would seem, is that once Aboriginal people had been civilised and Christianised, they would be then equipped to re-enter colonial society. The problem tends to be is that these reserves were often very poorly funded. The quality of schooling often wasn't very good. Often because they were poorly resourced, they actually offered very little employment for Aboriginal people. And what happens really generation by generation is that Aboriginal people probably became very, very dependent on these reserves and on the sort of government oversight. And there's ways in which Aboriginal people are, if you like, disenfranchised. The skills that they need in order to survive, let alone flourish in the wider world, they don't acquire those skills.
In highly colonised parts of Australia, like New South Wales, these reserves were run by the Aboriginal Protection Board. Heidi Norman is Professor in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Technology, Sydney.
By the time the Aborigines Protection Board comes into existence by the late 1800s, a regime starts to emerge, and that regime becomes ideological in the sense that it's based on classifying people according to their descent, so, you know, quarter caste, half caste, etc., the real fixation with this process of classification. But really things do change by the turn of the century, by the beginning of the 1900s, and we see a much more interventionist regime where the Aborigines Protection Board, on one hand, they start to control these reserves and missions, and in places like Brewarrina, the white townsfolk become very anxious about the increasing population of Aboriginal residents on the reserve. And they invoke two key strategies to push Aboriginal people further out of town. And one is segregation in schools and segregation in the hospital. And once the schools were segregated, a key strategy to implement those sort of segregations was the threat of the removal of children. So the removal of children was a really posed such a threat over the lives of Aboriginal people. And it was a way of controlling populations and herding you into areas that were on the outskirts of town, you know, on the other side of the river, on the other side of the railway tracks. So by the 20th century, what we start to see is a silencing, a marginalisation, an invisibility of Aboriginal people in the spaces of towns and cities.
Expressed briefly, the policy in regard to full-blooded Aboriginals is that everything possible should be done to stop the drift of natives into towns, to provide water where required on Aboriginal reserves, to make the reserves habitable and more attractive to the people who live in them. The policy is being carried out by government organisations and approved missions, working in fullest possible cooperation. The field staff of the Native Affairs branch is being built up by the appointment of cadet patrol officers, selected young men of good character and education, preferably with training and experience in agriculture, animal husbandry, or other appropriate subjects.
I don't think was too different across jurisdictions. The MO was pretty much the same, lock them up and control their lives.
Mick Dodson, Professor at the Australian National University and Yawuru man from Broome.
Control where they move, where they work, who they can marry, where they can live, take their children off them, you know, destroy their language, discourage cultural practices. That was the MO. Probably learnt from the British who did it elsewhere. It was essentially an attempt to destroy people as a people, you know, as a separate culture, separate languages, separate world views, separate religious and spiritual traditions, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they weren't very imaginative. It was pretty much the same, not just in this country, but where the West colonised other native peoples around the world.
I think probably the main differences in control have to do with geography. There are some parts of Australia where until the 1950s, there was effectively no control over Aboriginal people, whereas there are other parts of Australia where every person classified as Aboriginal was known, had a file, and was subject to control, though whether they were actually being controlled depended a little bit on how they were faring in the labour market. If they were unemployed and dependent on the state, they were likely to get more control.
In southern Australia, there were Aboriginals and Torres Strait Islanders who did manage to evade these controls, but they paid a high price. Jacqueline Troy is Director, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Research, University of Sydney.
A lot of people escaped from these repressive regimes by having to sort of renounce their Aboriginality. So if you were prepared to say that you were a mainstream person, that you weren't living like an Aboriginal person, whatever that actually means, you were exempt from having to be incarcerated on these group areas. But it also meant that for people who made the decision to move out of the missions and out of the reserves, they had to give up easy access to their families. Many people were left stranded away from their own family members who were still under the reserve system. So in New South Wales, we had the Aborigines Protectorate Board. This was the kind of terminology used all over Australia. The idea is that we were being protected by being grouped into areas where other people couldn't easily come in, other non-Aboriginal people, and also Aboriginal people who'd sort of given up their Aboriginality, at least on the surface.
You're listening to Rear Vision on RN. I'm Annabelle Quince. By the 1930s and 40s, it was clear that the indigenous population was no longer in decline, and that the number of so-called half-castes was actually increasing. So had these protectionist policies worked?
I've tried to survey all the local studies of Aboriginal populations that I could, and these are mainly studies that are about particular missions or settlements. And when you look at them, they all point to the same conclusion, that the introduction of some kind of controls, including the provision of medical care and perhaps some attention to diet, did arrest the decline of the Aboriginal population. So, in other words, institutional interventions, the institutional management of the Indigenous population, although it was very heavy-handed, it did have a biologically protective effect.
The realisation, I think, becomes particularly apparent in the 1920s in the southwest of Western Australia, where suddenly they realise that the population is growing, that there are these large families of mixed descent people. I mean, the Aboriginal people had clearly had developed the resistance to the diseases that had killed them off generations before. And so in the 1920s, there were some people who said, well, this is a wonderful thing. We must now develop policies for the future. But there were others who said, well, the half-caste problem, it is a menace. And there was a lot of talk about the half-caste menace. And in particular, the concern about intermixture, of trying to stop the breeding of these mixed descent people. And that's why they started taking light-coloured children away, so they could be absorbed. They did not want self-conscious Aboriginal minority developing. And this is certainly true of the 1920s and 1930s.
My mother was removed from her peoples in an area called Alpurrulam, which is 7 hours' drive from Camarwheel, and you swing back into the Northern Territory border. My mother was taken from there, stolen, kidnapped really, which was the policy of the day, to pick up the lighter-skinned kids because they had white blood in them and needed to be removed from all of their families. And this happened, of course, all over the country. We're not too sure how old she was. The only record of her, an official record of her, is a rather detailed police reports. And there's a notation that says something like, half-caste child Molly picked up today, approximately 8 years old. So we're not sure about that. She might have been a little bit older, but certainly she has clear recollection. The police were the agents of this policy. Her family knew they were in the area and they ran off in the bush with her out of the West Station people. And so we worked on the stations. They took Mum and ran off into the bush with her and stayed out in the bush. And she talks about this time quite vividly. They thought the police had gone and they crept back to the community and the police were still there and rode into the camp and whisked her up. She can remember being scooped up by men on horseback. They rode all the way up to Borroloola and she was put on a boat. And she hadn't seen the sea, and she remembers with a little pannikin putting it over the side of the ship to drink drink some water because she was thirsty, and of course that's the first time she tasted salt water. So anyhow, she was taken to Darwin and incarcerated in Carlin Compound. Often my mum tells stories of being hungry and eating bark off the trees, and also stories about the local Larrakia people, whose country it is, Darwin is situated, would actually come to the fence and give the kids fish and food and what have you and try to keep them okay or as much as they could. So she was there, as was the policy of the day, until the only way she could leave the compound was to marry out meaning to marry white, and that the superintendent of native welfare had to okay this, and he had to be a reasonable, upstanding person. So she was about 18 then when that happened.
Despite these policies and the removal of Indigenous kids, in many parts of northern Australia, agricultural industries were dependent on an Indigenous labour force.
The station's 100 Aboriginal stockmen, with their 100 dependents, are camped in the dry bed of the Victoria River, with little shade from 90-degree heat, dust and flies. Here in the vast outback, 600 miles south of Darwin, I listened to allegations of deprivation and inhumanity, of Aborigine claims that on some stations they live like dogs in huts they have to crawl into. Their food, salt beef and damper.
Aboriginal people were very self-organising. That is, they often contracted to do work as teams, kinship-based teams. I think that Aboriginal men in particular were very important parts of the wool industry in shearing, certainly in the cattle industry, and in land clearing and fencing. I mean, I think Australia could always have prospered and developed economically without an Aboriginal workforce, because Australia was very good at meeting labour needs by importing people. You know, we're a country of immigrants. I don't want to overstate the importance of Aborigines to the rural economy. I'd rather put it round the other way and say the importance of the rural economy to Aboriginal people being able to live independently in a way that minimised their dependence on the state and the supervision by the state.
Others in my family were allowed to work on stations and they were given exemption certificates.
Marcia Langton, Professor of Indigenous Studies at Melbourne University.
Were drovers, sheep station workers, domestic servants. And so the historians call this system indentured labour. Much of it was actually slavery.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. No. This was certainly true right across Western Australia and the Northern Territory. Queensland, with their Protection Act, early in the 20th century, they began to demand that there would be money paid, but it wasn't paid to the Aborigines. It was paid to the local protector, who was usually the local police sergeant. And people had accounts and they had to go and try and persuade the police sergeant to give them some money from their account. And there's no doubt there was also a great deal of purloining and taking this money, both by individuals and also by the government. And this has ongoing ramifications of legal action because the wages were rarely given to the actual workers. But still in Western Australia and the Northern Territory, people were given, you know, a bit of tobacco and maybe a shirt or two every year and that's all. But on a big cattle station, for instance, big sheep station in the West, maybe only 10% of the Aboriginal community on that station actually worked. The others were dependents. And this was a strange and quite unique situation. But it did mean, yes, that the individuals didn't get any money and people would say, well, what would the niggers do with it? You know, it's no point giving them any money.
Despite the restrictions imposed by these protectionist policies, there were forms of resistance from urban and rural Indigenous communities.
In two places, there were strikes by Indigenous people. There may be more than two, but I'm only aware of two. One was in the Torres Strait in 1936, when many Torres Strait Islanders refused their labour to the pearling boats until they got more transparent dealings about their wages, until some of the imposing authority of the local state officials was lifted from them, and until they got local councils. That was one very notable strike, I think very important in helping to shape this Queensland government sense that the Torres Strait Islanders needed to be handled differently from the Aborigines. And the other notable action was in 1946 in the Pilbara region, where Aboriginal pastoral workers walked off the job. They were encouraged to do so by a communist activist, Don McLeod, which alarmed Cold War thinking white Australians greatly to think that Aboriginal people could be dupes of the communists. But a more intelligent assessment of that time, which came from a man called Bateman, appointed by the West Australian government, was that maybe the seeds of this worker discontent in the Pilbara were created by the pastoralists themselves and also by their allies, the police.
In terms of the Communist Party, there's an important figure by the name of Tom Wright, who was a member of the Communist Party and a trade unionist in New South Wales. And in 1939, he writes an important pamphlet called A New Deal for Aborigines. And he does a new edition in 1944, and it becomes the policy of the Communist Party of Australia.
it adopts a policy in regard to Aboriginal people. Perhaps the role of the Communist Party is most important in Western Australia when in 1946 Aboriginal stock workers in the Pilbara in northwest Western Australia go on strike, or at least that's how their political action is described. And the Aboriginal people there eventually walk off the pastoral stations and eventually, by the time you get to the early 1950s, have formed what is essentially a cooperative movement. In what happens between 1946 and 1949, the Communist Party of Australia, or at least the Western Australian branch, is crucial in supporting that strike. And we're talking about people like the poet Dorothy Hewitt. And then later on, in the formation of organisations like the Council for Aboriginal Rights, which is an organisation founded in Melbourne in 1951. It's a white organisation. And the principal figures, Shirley Andrews, Barry Christophers, Pauline Pickford, they are all members of the Communist Party. And there are other communists who also play a role in the campaign for Aboriginal rights. It's really Christians and communists amongst white people, amongst white Australians, who are crucial in the struggle for Aboriginal rights.
You have both an urban Aboriginal movement, but also you get developments in the more remote areas of people beginning to demand more rights. The communists were important, but there was also by this time the intrusion of international ideas and standards. I mean, the League of Nations had standards for the relationship with so-called primitive people. There was the idea of trusteeship, and Australia took over the trusteeship of what had been the German New Guinea, where there were standards they had to abide by and where Australia could be called to account. And so many people said, well, why can't we treat our Aborigines in the same way? So that, in a way, international ideas were coming into Australia. But the activism was indeed both urban and remote.
I think actually there had always been protests at the way that particularly Aboriginal people were treated. There's some very interesting correspondence from the frontiers, from settlers, from people who'd taken up land, who offered refuge to local Aboriginal people who were being hunted. Some of these stories are quite incredible. And of course, Aboriginal people themselves were protesting from very early on at their treatment. For instance, the famous 1938 gathering called the Day of Mourning in Sydney. While the state was celebrating its sesquicentenary and had forcibly brought troops of Aborigines from the far west down to reenact Governor Phillips' Landing, at the very same time, there were hundreds of Aborigines meeting in a hall on what is now George Street, passing resolutions about how badly they were treated, asking for land rights, asking to not be starved and to have some rights.
Marcia Langton ending today's program. You also heard from Henry Reynolds, Tim Rouse, Pat Anderson, Jacqueline Troy, Mick Dodson, Heidi Norman and Bain Atwood. Next week, part two, from assimilation to self-determination. We go from the end of World War II through to the 1967 referendum, the Tent Embassy, and the beginning of land rights. Today's sound engineer is Isabella Tropiano. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.